So this is John Costa. Welcome to this week's Spotlight on Heritage recording. It'll go out on Saw Sound and also as a podcast. And I've got three guests, special guests this week, to mark the 120th anniversary of the Unemployed March in 1905 from Leicester to London, when about 400 men set off with lots of energy and goodwill and intention of raising the plight of the unemployed. And certainly, I think it's been quite shocking to read some of the comments that were made about them and what kind of people they were and what they stood for. So I'm hoping to tease that out with my three special guests this week. So first of all, I'd like to, if you can introduce yourself, Jess.
I'm Jess Jenkins. I used to be an archivist at the Record Office in Wigston. And 20 years ago, I was involved in doing an exhibition on the Unemployed March to celebrate its centenary. And it's a fascinating subject. It's a very inspiring story, I think. And I think that it's important that we don't forget it, even now.
Okay, brilliant. And I've also got Sue. Sue, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, thanks. I'm Sue Lester. I'm the publicity officer for Leicestershire and Rutland Family History Society. And we're hoping that we can get very involved in looking at possibly some of the people involved in the march and finding out a bit more about it along the way ourselves.
Brilliant. Thanks, Sue. And finally, Robin.
I'm Robin Jenkins. I was also at the Record Office for a long time. I'm now really interested in the military men who were on the march. I'm working on a book on the Leicestershire Regiment in the South African War. And like a lot of projects with Jess, I found that our interests coincide very strangely, remarkably. And this has been the case with the Unemployed March because so many of them were ex-servicemen.
Yes, that certainly, as a ex-military man myself, was one of the things that stood out to me reading your book. So, Jess, how did you first come across the story? Can you remember?
Yes, yeah, so we were researching a book, actually, on the century of Leicester, a photographic book. And there were odd photographs in that of the march. And I hadn't even heard of it, so I was fascinated by it. And the more I looked into it, the more there was to find. And what is particularly valuable about the march is that afterwards, Amos Sheriff, who was one of the leaders, collected together as many photographs as he could. And he took them to a dispensing chemist in Highcross Street, who was also a lanternist, and got him to change them into lantern slides and had them coloured. So it's very unusual to have coloured pictures of events in 1905, but it does mean they're fascinating photographs, but very vivid as well.
So where did he get these photographs from? Who had taken them?
I think people along the road. I think there are occasions when the newspapers say, there was a camera fiend active here, and there are suddenly a lot of slides. And I think he said, if you can contact me afterwards, we'll work something out. Some days there are no pictures, particularly the wet days. But on the sunny days, there's, a lot of camera, especially as it became more famous and more popular. That's when the cameras came out.
You have a very nice postcard, haven't you, a photograph, and it was clearly taken from the front windows of somebody's house. And he says that the photographer gave him a couple of copies of the postcard.
As payment, that's right.
I don't know if you brought that one.
Yes, that's right. It was from Fenny Stratford. And in fact, there are no photographs. So Amos didn't find that photographer. And there are no photographs in his slideshow of that day at all. Right. So it's very nice. And that's what I'm hoping this project will do, uncover some of the things that still aren't known, like those photographers, those private photographers who just kept a few photographs and in the family.
Now, this book that you've written here, which Tom is kindly passing me now, very detailed. Obviously, it's got quite a sort of day, not so much a day-to-day breakdown, but more about sort of the sections that they walked from Leicester to London and back again. And what's quite interesting is that you've got a couple of reporters from newspapers as well that are participating, which I think is quite interesting as well, isn't it? Sort of they realise the newsworthiness of it participate.
Yes.
But it wasn't the first march, was it? The one that had recently from
From Raunds, that's right. In May, there was a strike, a long-term strike in Raunds amongst the boot and shoemakers there. And they decided to march to London to speak to the War Office and say how unfair it was that the War Office was not paying the prices it had been paying during the war. And so they set off with 115 men to London. And it was a different sort of march. For a start, they had good shoes, which the poor Leicester men didn't have. But it was sponsored by trade unions, and they took with them journalists who sometimes paid for their meals and things. So it was a publicity stunt. And it was quite successful, not in so much as the War Office wouldn't see him, but he went and went into the Strangers' Gallery at the House of Commons, the leader, James Gribble, this is, and he interrupted a debate about women's suffrage, actually, which I'm not so happy about, but he interrupted it by saying, what about fairness for the boot and shoemakers? And this sort of electrified the country, and they drew attention to the whole dispute. The War Office wouldn't see him. They marched back to Raunds, but it was seen as a great success because it brought their grievance to light. And the War Office said, right, all right, we'll have an inquiry, and they did restore the prices. So it was a total success. And Amos Sheriff in Leicester, where there was terrible unemployment, as across the country, said, well, we can do the same. I'm going to take 1,000 men and we're going to march to London. We'll camp out under the stars and we'll rely on donations. And the Labour Party would say, no, this is not a good idea. And the Labour Party were dead against it. The prospective MP for Leicester, of course, was Ramsay MacDonald. And he said, no, this is untold suffering. This would just cause distress. And really what was at the back of their minds was these men could cause trouble, you know. And that's the interesting thing about the march, that when they start off, they're reviled by a lot of the newspapers. People say, oh, they're criminals. They're not employed because they're worthless. They shouldn't come here.
And like there were layabouts.
Exactly. And there was competition saying, no, don't come here. We can't afford it. So there's an awful lot of bad publicity. And I think the triumph of the march is that Amos Sheriff said, no, we'll go. Okay, I'll temper it a bit. He cut it down to 500. He had 700 volunteers for this march. And he cut it down to 500. And he said, this is going to be a display of your best part. So there's no drinking on this march. Anyone who drinks will lose their badge and be excluded from the march. And they gathered together on Victoria Park, and I think about 450 badges were given to participants. Amos Sheriff said that this is a badge of honour, and you will lose it if you behave badly. And I think the fascinating thing about it is that he inspired the men with an ideal, so that everyone had been so afraid, and yet it turned into a triumph, and the men behaved in an exemplary fashion.
It does remind me of this kind of tale of two marches. There's the media coverage, which we need to think about 120 years ago, dominated everything. And that's the only way, pre-television, pre-radio, this was the only way you've learned about anything was through the media, newspapers particularly. Yet actually your document here that you've produced actually tells a different tale of welcoming them and coming out and offering a lot of things.
Very interesting, yeah. What I should say is that Sheriff, when he showed his slides afterwards, the first thing he started off was three pictures of the three reporters that went on the march with them. One from the Leicester Daily Post, one from the Leicester Evening Mail, and one who wrote for the Labour Leader and for the Leicester Labour Paper, Leicester Pioneer. So it's interesting that he led off his talk talking about those. And they weren't in a position to fund the march. So it's a different setup from Raunds. But it just shows how important it was that they were giving their reports, in contrast to some of the papers, which were openly hostile. And a good example is Market Harborough, which is where they spent the first night. If you read the Market Harborough advertiser, nobody wants them. It's terrible. This is going to cost £14, all this food, all this bread and straw. It's terrible. They shouldn't come cadging. And yet you read people who were on the march talking about it and say, well, a lot of people turned out to welcome us. So it's very interesting, the two halves, as you say.
Yeah. So Sue, I mean, from a family history perspective and with your research centre here, you know, discovering an event like this that's got over 400 participants, you know, whether you've got records of those men or not, they had families and, you know, were probably registered to where they lived in Leicester. And I think for me, that's can we find some of these people, do you think?
Well, one thing I was going to ask Jess was, how much information have you got in terms of names of the people who went on the march?
Well, it's very disappointing in that after the Bronze March, they were all given certificates and there's a list of all the men who took part. I know it's only 115, but seems so. Nothing like that for Leicester. The only names I've got are bits I've extracted from newspaper accounts across the country, and I've got about 35 names. So that's 35 out of 450 left. 416 got medals at the end. So it's a lot of people that we haven't got names for. Now, 20 years ago, we did an appeal and it was picked up by the BBC, and we got a couple of people who knew they had the medal and didn't know what their ancestors had done. And that was great. So I'm hoping there's still people out there who've got the medal in the family and don't know what it's about. And the more names we could uncover, it would be brilliant, you know.
Well, I'd certainly see that we could put out an inquiry in our journal, for instance, saying, do you have any knowledge of family members whom you should take?
Yeah, that would be brilliant. Yeah.
Alongside anything you do with local publicity, obviously with a picture of the medal, which might prompt some interest. And if we did have some names, and I was just thinking, obviously, there are things that we could look at, like, well, where were these people in the 1901 census?
Yeah.
Where were they in 1911? Obviously, you've looked at newspaper reports, but there is more information going online all the time.
Exactly, yeah.
And therefore, you might uncover additional stories. So, you know, from a small starting point, it would be nice if that could be expanded into a larger number, which is quite often what happens, we find. You know, you put out an inquiry and suddenly numbers develop.
That would be brilliant.
Because people have got a knowledge. You know, I'm sure it's something that people would have mentioned, you know, to future generations. You imagine they would have done so. But obviously the Leicester Mercury is a good avenue as well to explore.
Yes.
And I guess these medals as well, Jess, that you mentioned, yes. Like I said, people having them and not really knowing what they are. Like, yes. They're not military medals, so what are they?
Exactly. I think that's a clue sometimes when people don't know it. There's a slight problem in that it's connected with unemployment, and there's still slightly, people think, oh, you know, that's not so impressive as, say, being a striker or something like that, which is totally wrong. But I think there's that element as well. So quite often when I spoke to descendants, they said, oh, I never talked about it, but I see they've got this medal. So that's another slight problem with it. But I mean, the more we could do to celebrate their achievement, I think it would be better. That'd be brilliant.
Now, before I bring Robin in talking about the sort of the military aspect, there is a memorial stone in Marketplace.
That's right.
Which is very difficult to see at the moment with all the changes that are going on. But was that from the time, or has that been there subsequently?
That was put up for the centenary.
And who organised that? What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, I think Ned Newitt was behind it, and the City Council. I know he's done work on this as well, and that, I think that's that they put a commemorative slab. But at the same time, Raunds celebrated the centenary, and they recreated the march through the village, which was very good, even down to having someone on crutches, because they had someone on crutches. We went and looked on it.
We did
long a look, and it was very, very moving. And they put up a wonderful memorial. And as I say, the names are recorded somewhere. So
the shopkeepers were dressed as 1905 shopkeepers with aprons up here. This was, you know, it was really
they did it very well. Yes, yes.
Maybe that's something we aim for at the end of our 12 months.
Well, all right.
After today, 12 months time, if we could do something, hopefully the new market place will be by there as well. Hopefully a bit more open and recreate some of these incredible images. So Robin, bringing yourself in about the South African wars, because obviously a lot of these guys that were involved in it that had previously been involved in the African wars would have been come back, either have left the army or been injured. would they have all been from the Leicestershire Regiment back then, 120 years ago? Were you living or retiring where you'd the military unit you'd served in?
Most of them were, but not all, no. They were from all sorts of units. There's a Durham Light Infantryman who was on the march. There are all sorts of peculiar people who bob up, and they either are from Leicester but had wandered and joined a regiment somewhere else, or they were from somewhere else who'd come to Leicester and happened to be in Leicester when they thought, I'll try the army. A lot of them were Leicestershire militiamen. That seems to have been a common entry into the army, that people perhaps were, I suspect a lot of them were a bit too small and puny for the army. They didn't quite fit the...
So explain to me what a militiaman would have been 120 years ago. Are we talking someone like, you know, the territorial army, like reserves, or just fairly locally?
It's sort of part-time, a dad's army, like the territorials or the reserves are now, that they were required to do 40 days a year, something like that. And they would receive pay while they were serving. And it was, a Saturday afternoon soldiers. It's that sort of thing. They would have been embodied in an emergency. You know, if the country was invaded or something like that, they would have been embodied. And in fact, the Leicestershire militia went to South Africa. In 1901, they at the end of the Boer War, they went and they occupied some blockhouses. So they were embodied and sent. But it was a sort of reserve sort of thing for the army. And a lot tried that, I think, either as a, what's the army like? I'll see if the militia suits me, then the regulars might. And I think others were told, well, you're a bit small for the army, but I'll tell you what, if you go in the militia for a few months, we'll get you in sort of a side door. So it was a route to the regular army as well.
So a lot of these men coming back from fighting in the South African War would have come back to unemployment, because again, the factories would have gone back to not being on a war footing. As always, you know, war's good for business, as our government at the moment knows full well, with factories and submarines and stuff. So they'd have come back to this land for heroes, which were kind of instantly reminding me of sort of post-World War One or post-World War Two, setting up the NHS, this land fit for heroes. And you come back and discover that you're going back to something that's probably paying you less than when you were served in the army.
A lot of them came back from South Africa either ill or wounded, and they would receive some sort of pension, but the pensions I don't think were enough to keep you. You know, there was a system where you were given a percentage inability, if you like, or disability, and you got a payment according to that. So they expected you to do some work, and we would chip in. And luckily, a lot of the records survive, quite remarkable, the survival rate of the records and the ease of finding, if you know the bloke's name, this is the key to it. One of the main ones, one of the most notable figures, was a chap called Baxter. And he's well known because he was one-legged and he rode a bicycle. So he stood out and his name is taken. And he's a very interesting character, but he's not really all he's cut out to be, if you know what I mean. He was clearly a charismatic character, and it was said he'd lost his leg in action, Burma.
Spent all it.
Yeah, it's complete rubbish. He was lost his leg in...
Well, I've got a book here that says, by a lady called Jess Jenkins, who said he lost his leg for a spent bullet. So is that rubbish, is it?
Yeah, it's rubbish. It's subsequent research, you say. Subsequent research has proved he actually lost his leg through... osteoarthritis in Bermuda. He was serving with the 1st Battalion, the Leicestershire Regiment in Bermuda.
But as a result of enteric fever.
He got enteric fever, as a lot did. It was quite a scandal at the time how, you know, that enteric comes from bad water. So they were badly housed and the sewage and water systems were appalling, and an awful lot of soldiers in Bermuda died from enteric fever. He didn't, but he did lose his leg. He came back and he got a pension, but it wasn't enough to live on. But his records are fascinating because it tells you what sort of a bloke he was. And you might think he was a war hero. Well, he wasn't quite a war hero because he hadn't seen any active service. He's a man worthy of sympathy, absolutely. But also his military records show a very interesting sort of... what he was up to, and the sort of problems he had as well, getting back into civilian life and so on. And he actually forfeited his pension twice through imprisonment for assault, believe it or not. So again, a remarkable one-legged man going to prison for assault isn't quite what you think. And even in by 1935, so this is 30 years later, he forfeits his pension because he's going to prison. Mm. We don't know why he went to prison, but he did. So to my mind, he's not quite the man we thought he was, but he's even more interesting than we thought he was.
I also think it underlines the success of Amos Sheriff, that he took 400 men to London and back. And,
which is no mean feat, is it? Really?
Well, could you imagine what you'd feel like in your village if 400 unemployed men, down and outs, really, marched in? You'd be afraid, wouldn't you? You could understand why they were afraid going. But coming back, it was a triumph. And Dunstable, the mayor, turned out with the band. They were welcomed as heroes. Kettering, a wonderful. And I read a letter later to Amos saying, well, what you realised was, I was against that. George Banton, this was, a Labour councillor. And he said, I was against it because I thought there'd be trouble. And you were better than that. You knew that you could inspire them with something more important than themselves, that you inspired
something
them.
Bigger, a calling.
Exactly. And the religious theme is very important because Amos Sheriff is a very committed Christian. So they go everywhere singing hymns and things like that. But he did. He managed to inspire. And I say Amos Sheriff, but of course there were two other leaders, including Frederick Donaldson, the vicar of St. Mark's. But they managed to inspire the men with an ideal that was better. And so there was no violence, no arrests or anything. The only time the police were needed was when interlopers tried to get in and get some of the bread and bully beef and things like that. And they were very proud on the way back because they stopped providing a police escort.
I think...
Yeah, well, very significant. So even though you know these are men who've suffered from life, they've had a hard time, they've been imprisoned... Yes. They were inspired to this march and did very well.
I think it's a great truth that soldiers in peacetime often get into trouble, but in wartime they rise to the occasion. And I think this march was like that, that the rogues, if you like, rose to the occasion. Charles Baxter became a leader of the march in the end. He was wasn't he riding ahead on his bicycle?
They said, there's another quote in your book as well here that says something about he did more with one leg and one pedal than other people did.
And there, one other thing I would say about the soldier that brings it home to me that I thought was delightful, that of course on the march they got to Wellingborough and they were being passed by steam lorries from Whitworth's flour mills. And the great joke was that these were the armoured trains. And of course, they'd had armoured trains in South Africa. And they allowed odd people to travel on them, didn't they?
They took 80 men.
80 men. They transported 80 men. They didn't have to walk for a bit. You know, they gave them a lift. And this was regarded as perfectly acceptable. This is, you know, it was sort of, catching a lift isn't good. You've got to do the march. But on the other hand, if you go on one of the armoured trains, well, that's fine. They're the wounded being carried on the armoured trains. And back we are 5 years into South Africa.
Yeah. Very rarely I read a document and I go through the emotional roller coaster of being incredibly angry about how they were written about and the way they were treated. And particularly like when you look at it from the lens of 2025, 120 years later, misinformation, disinformation, downright lies that were told about people, through to it being very inspiring with the way that people supported them and what they did, you know, small acts of kindness and the barber coming out and giving free shaves to people and stuff.
Oh, yes.
But also looking at things like, you know, they set out to speak to the king and is it the Archbishop of Canterbury, both of whom refused to see them?
Yeah.
But, you know, when they came back, there's this, I like it where you describe it at one of the first meetings afterwards with Amos Sheriff, where people are saying to him, like, well, you stayed in a hotel and you did this and, you know, obviously inspired by what they did for 2 weeks, but then found that they just returned to normality.
Yeah.
But without the speed of things are going to change quite quickly. So do you think there was more gained from participating in the march than not going?
Well, I think that's true. Most of all, they showed the country what poverty, meant and also what good citizens they were. I think that was the thing that Amos Sheriff emphasised more and more, that we've shown them what, that we're responsible people. There was the Times talking about them being simpletons and unemployable, or shirkers, awful things said about them. But of course, they showed that they were honourable citizens, and that was inspiring. But it was also inspiring that they created a fellowship, so they all had a purpose, a common purpose. So there was that aspect as well, that it was such a successful venture from that point of view.
Now, you also mentioned about faith and, you know, people's involvement in Christianity and, religion, and there was temperance movement as well. You kind of touch on all of those things in there. Do you think something like this could happen today in 2025? Do you think 120 years later we'd be able to galvanise people into doing something like this that were affected by things that are still prevalent today, you know, hopelessness, turning servicemen.
Yes, I'm sure we could. You mentioned the generosity on the march. On the journey to Bedford, it's pouring heavy rain all day. Men didn't have coats. So along the way, people are handing out sacks for them to put over themselves and things like that. One place they stop in Yardley Hastings, I think, and an old lady serves up a jug of cocoa. That won't have gone far, but that was happening along the way. And I'm sure that essential goodness of people is still there, but it maybe needs to be motivated. We need to feel compassion again. I thought 20 years ago, I never thought we would be in the situation we are today with food banks everywhere. And I never thought we would ever doubt that people were unemployed because they were victims of the system. But now the idea that, you're unemployed because you're worthless is current again. So, it's extraordinary. So maybe we need a march. we need something like
that. And that's what I thought, looking at this book. I mean, if you were to change the cover, put a modern cover on it and put 2025 and hand it out to people, whether they'd actually be able to tell you that it was 120 years out of date, because it would be completely contemporary and relevant today as ever. So is this one of the things that's really important about family history, that we keep these stories in people's minds because they have a connection to them, particularly if they're all kind of Leicester born and bred?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of my things that I've spoken to you about is how many hidden stories there are that people don't necessarily pass on a story about a grandparent. And without that knowledge, if you haven't recorded it in some way, it's lost. And sometimes you can find out a little bit researching, but nothing can really replace that personal story that you have heard from a grandparent or a cousin or something like that. So as I've said to you before, that's one thing I'm particularly interested in encouraging when people are researching, not just facts on a page. I mean, newspaper reports often bring out a different aspect of people's lives, not just a date or a fact in a census, but, they might have done something in a newspaper which is sort of quite interesting and that you had no knowledge of at all. So I do encourage that. It's not just that narrow path in research. It's a wider picture. And it certainly, if they'd all spoken about it, we'd have all 400 names moving forward, wouldn't we?
I think that's, for me, particularly coming with Mum to a couple of your talks recently, where you were talking about looking at your family history almost like sideways in both directions, rather than thinking of it from a linear perspective. Well, sometimes you've got a photograph, like one of these images that Jess has brought with her, or the napkin, or the medal, and you might not know, but it's about looking at, well, what happened at the time? What is this? Why would they have had it? Had they inherited it? Did the person who gave it to you even know what it was? It's just one of those things that ended up being in a box. Do people come to you with these kind of stories? Is it one of the best things about doing events and stuff?
Well, they probably come more to an outside event with a box of photographs or memorabilia than coming into the research centre. And, we all know the dilemma of a box of photographs with no names on and how you're going to possibly identify people. One of the things is get that box of photographs out and talk about who's in the photographs. And if you honestly don't know and it's not a particularly interesting photograph, maybe put it to one side, but focus on the stories of the people that you can identify, albeit a grandmother, grandfather or whatever, take things forward.
So Jess, tell us a little bit about the images that you've got. I know you've rescued some of them as well, and some are held at the County Records Office in Stuttgart. Right.
Yes.
When was that assembled? Was that used by Amos Sheriff for meetings and stuff?
Yes, I think he went round showing them, talking about the march, raising money, further money for the unemployed. I think that's how he used it for. And eventually his daughter gave it to Newark Houses, and the coloured slides remained there until we did the exhibition. And then they were taken to the record office, and they've been digitised since. So, but there's still plenty of things. Occasionally something will come up on eBay or whatever, like the postcard we mentioned of Fenny Stratford. There must be plenty of postcards and things out there, which Amos Sheriff never saw. But
so we just need to get the word out.
I think so. I mean, they had a triumphant entry into Kettering, and there were said to be cameras everywhere. I've never seen a photograph of the entrance into Kettering at all. So I do think that the more we can appeal, it'd be interesting to find out what else is still out there.
Robin, what kind of reception do you think someone had returning from service? It's interesting that the letter that was, you know, sent to the king about, you know, sort of the fatherland, and here we are, we've served, and we want to come and share with you this, you know, what we'll come back to. I mean, is it very different from our reception of soldiers after World War One and World War Two from the Boer War? Because it seems like a different world completely.
I think the reception of soldiers was changing. In the 19th century, certainly the army was regarded as almost an unsuitable employment. It wasn't quite respectable. You know, somebody famously said, in fact, Sir William Robertson's mother said, "I'd rather see you dead than in a red coat." And he rose to become chief of the Imperial General Staff. So he did very well. But it wasn't quite respectable. But by the 1880s, 1890s, it was a job with a pension, a pay scale and progression and promotion and things like that. And it was becoming a respectable job for a family man to have. And so social ideas of a soldier were improving. I think the anti-army feeling died hard, and soldiers were regarded as a rough lot and troublesome. But when they came back from the Boer War, they'd had 3 years of Rudyard Kipling writing poems about Tommy this and Tommy that, and chuck him out the brute, but it's thin red line of heroes when the guns begin to shoot, that sort of thing, and collecting charitable money for soldiers in South Africa. There was a big appeal for the gentleman in khaki. And that says it all, doesn't it? The gentleman in khaki. That's your Thomas Atkins, is now a gentleman. I think 1902, when they came back from the war and were discharged, there was a feeling that the country was impoverished. They'd sent 500,000 men to fight in South Africa, and they came back, and how are you going to pay for this? And there's always a reluctance, which we see now, to pay our debts, in a way that governments are always reluctant to tax us to pay our debts to the men who've done the work. But I think soldiers were more respectable. They were more looked to. And also there was a feeling that there was a European war coming. And if we weren't careful, we wouldn't have an army to fight it. The South African war had shown one very important thing, is that physically the population was very, very poor. It's quite startling when you look at the records which survive of enlistment, because, of course, they recorded the physical condition of soldiers, their height and so on. And they are all of them. I mean, Charlie Baxter, he was 5'5". Now, 5'5" is 4 inches below average height now, 4 inches below. And most of them are 5'3", 5'4", this sort of thing. Very rare to find a man of 5'7", 8", or even 9". So physical specimens of wrestlers, their weights, you know, Charlie Baxter was 122 pounds. Right, I'd love to be 122 pounds, but, you know, at my height, it would be, I'd be a skeleton, basically. And they, you know, when they inflated their chests, they were reaching 33 inches and things like that. Well, we can cut 10 inches on that nowadays.
Now, talking about these men, You know, we talk about, you know, going on the march, and yes. obviously it was men that were doing it, you know, representing 2,000 men and their families.
Yes.
And I think this is the thing from, I want to bring you in again, Jess, about, you know, and their families. What was the interest at the time in the families, the wives and the children left behind, or was it just the pure focus on the men?
I find it quite sad, the number of men who had to return home because suddenly they got a telegram saying their wife was dangerously ill or their child was dangerously ill. And it's a sort of indication of how powerless life was for you when you were this poor, with no food source.
And only being away for 2 weeks. I mean, yeah. It's not months. They were talking sort of 14 days, aren't we?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. So there was a party when they had the meeting in Trafalgar Square on the Sunday. They had a very good meeting in Trafalgar Square. A party of 50 from Leicester travelled up to see them. And amongst them, of course, was the future suffragette Alice Hawkins, whose husband was part of the march. And she cycled back with them to Leicester. So she actually appears in some of the photographs towards the end. And she and her husband, Alfred, who again was very active in the cause of women's suffrage, led the march into Kettering on the way back. So that's another reason for finding photographs of Kettering.
As a historian, an archivist, an author and that kind of stuff, when you look at a single event like this, when you take a step back and look at it overall, do you see, you know, the role that it played in things like, you know, women's suffrage, the unemployed bill that they were talking about, and that, so you know, it was an important thing. Was it all these sums of all of these things, the sum of the parts that improved your average person?
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. This march is very significant from the point of view of unemployed, but in London they were addressed by Annie Cobden Sanderson, who was later imprisoned as a suffragette. So the women involved in the labour cause were also, they were in the cause for women's suffrage because they wanted to change society. So it's obvious that they would be drawn to this sort of issue as well. Mm. So I think it's a great success in terms of getting the moving the conscience of the people, Amos Sheriff called it, so that they saw what was going on. And it must have been a contributory factor to the landslide victory for the Liberal government. Just another nail in the coffin of the Conservative government at that time, I think.
Mm. So let's bring it to a conclusion. And I'll ask each of you in turn, what would you suggest, what would you like to get out of this 12-month project as we look at the work that you've done, the groundwork that you've done? Is it more people? Is it raising the awareness of it, the consciousness of it?
I don't think it's something that Leicester should forget. I think it's something they should be very proud of. They should be proud of those men. I would love to know more of the names, and the more we can find out about them, the better. Yeah, I'd just like to find out more about the people who went on the march.
So I guess that fits with the role that you guys can do as helping support here at the Leicestershire and Rutland Family History Society.
Yes, I mean, I certainly think we could put together something that goes out to members, but mentioning Kettering and other counties, you've also got the option of writing to some neighbouring family history societies who might well be happy to ask their members, you know, because there might have been a story or a photograph that they're aware of that wouldn't necessarily come into the Leicestershire arena. Yeah. But certainly if we set ourselves a target of finding a few more, then...
Well, yeah, one story, I think, is good that we've uncovered, isn't it? You know what I mean? And Robin, just finally, you know, everything going on with Newark House's museum at the moment, reducing their hours, and we've got the Regimental Museum. This is a reason for people to visit, I guess, isn't it? So what happened to soldiers when they returned?
Yeah, it's part of the story, isn't it? I think I remember showing a very senior officer of the Leicestershire Regiment this display. He'd come to the record office for some other reason. I said, oh, here, this unemployed march. And he wasn't terribly interested. He was politely interested, but he wasn't terribly interested, till I pointed out, and this photograph here shows all the ex-servicemen, most of them Leicestershire Regiment. And he suddenly realised that this was something of interest to him as well. So it's, you know, it's a topic which involves everybody from different angles in different ways, whether it's a modern politician who sees some heritage thing in it, or a social campaigner, or a military historian like me. There's something for everybody in this.
Yeah. I was thinking as well, Jess, is finally with yourself, is there was a project with the East Midlands Oral History Archive, I think doing something around sort of terraced housing in Leicester. You know, all these associated projects as well, because these men all lived somewhere with their families before and after the march, didn't they? And, and continued, right. As Sue said about this, the census and all those sorts of things.
Yes, yes. Well, when they got home, they were all given a package of food. They got a bit of beef and some potatoes and a little bit of sugar. And that was their you know, constant. They got home and that's what they took home, a little parcel. And one of the patrons of the march, William Faulkner, gave £100 to be shared between them. So they all got about four and six each of that money. And then, of course, the problems were still there. Mm. And there was an unemployment bill passed later that year. And it's Keir Hardie was disgusted with it because it still relied on charity. But it was a start. At least they were recognising that there was a need that the authorities should play a role in, and it was the beginning. So I think it's important.
Well, I'm looking forward to the 12 months ahead, and in about 5 or 6 months as well, we've got the Saturday Heritage Fair on the 11th of October at the Leicester Adult Education Centre, where we're going to have a table and hopefully our social media outreach and contacting various people, and the article hopefully in the September, is it September, August, September?
Yes,
September issue.
September.
Yeah, we'll bring some people in with some interesting items, hopefully some photographs. And just, Jess, take us over the line with talking about the napkin that you've got there. What's the significance of that?
Well, this was a napkin given to all the marchers in Trafalgar Square, and I've never quite worked out who paid for it, but I think it was something like the Social Democratic Federation or one of the socialist societies. The Raunds marchers were all given one, and like the Leicester one, it has socialist slogans on it, and it has the programme for the week, and for the weekend. And of course, on the Saturday, when they were supposed to have a meeting in Marble Arch, there was a thunderstorm and it was completely washed out. So they weren't able to follow the programme that exactly. It was on the Sunday that they had the triumphant meeting in Trafalgar Square. But it's still interesting to me that that's been carefully preserved by someone all that time. It's a paper napkin, basically, so it could have been thrown away, and yet somebody valued it. And that's important, I think.
And these things still exist. We just need to find them.
Yes, that's right.
Great. Thank you very much for talking to me.